Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Remdesivir in clinical trials is showing promise in reducing the severity of COVID-19. The drug is made by Gilead Sciences. This is the same company that makes Tamiflu, which you might have been prescribed for a bout of the flu. So hold that thought for a moment about Gilead. Meanwhile, a coronavirus in cats, which is not the one that people are being infected by, causes a disease called feline infectious perionitis, or FIP. This is a rare disease. There's no cure. It's usually deadly. However, there is a more common form that's milder and survivable in cats. So now the merge of the two topics. About 5 years ago, a UC Davis researcher made a stunning discovery. Two different molecules from Gilead's library of compounds actually stopped FIP in cat cells. The researcher who found this out is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Niels Peterson, and he's joining us by phone from Davis. And Dr. Peterson, I'm really grateful that you made time for us on Insight. Hello.
Hello. How are you? Good?
I'm good. And we're healthy. How long ago did you start studying FIP in cats?
I started in my sophomore year of veterinary school, which was in 1964, 65, so it's been a long time.
In all these years, there must have been treatment trials and vaccine trials. Did anything come close to working?
No, the vaccines, many were tried and they failed. Some of them made the disease worse, not better, and many were not very protective. Treatments were purely symptomatic. We could extend life a little bit, but quality of life, but we couldn't save them. And the mortality was virtually 100%.
So I want to put that thought about cats aside for a moment. In light of what you just said, is that any indication about how long the struggle could be in finding a vaccine for COVID-19 in humans?
It's really hard to say. There's a lot of collective experience with coronavirus diseases in animals. You know, they exist in swine, they exist in poultry, they exist in cattle, horses. There are vaccines for poultry, there's vaccines for swine, there's a vaccine for cats. So there's a lot of experience with trying to control these diseases in animals, and based on that, and based on the experience with human coronavirus infections that cause common colds that have existed for decades in humans, I think we could probably predict that COVID will eventually become another one of those coronavirus diseases of man and animals that the species has to live with, that probably won't be very serious in terms of mortality and that.
What do you think a timetable for a human vaccine might be?
Well, I'm a little bit more pessimistic. Definitely, it's going to be years. It's not going to be 1 year. It probably won't be 2 years. My guess is that it'll be more than 2 years before a vaccine is universally available and applicable, if it's possible. I mean, there is a possibility that the vaccines will not work very well, and there is a outside chance that this disease will, or this virus will, adapt itself enough to humans that it will become another one of those common cold-like coronavirus infections that we see in wintertime, and just be another one that's added to the list of the four coronavirus infections that already exist. So by the time a vaccine is developed, there may or may not be a great need for it. So it's going to be an interesting time. It's going to be an interesting period, and it could go a lot of different directions.
Well, you and I go back in time to the 1980s. I was a young reporter covering HIV, and you were working on a vaccine trial then, and there was a team at UC Davis very convinced that within 5 years there would be a vaccine, and this struggle has been daunting.
Yes, it has, and it turns out that not all diseases are vaccinatable, and there have been many attempts to make a vaccine for HIV, and there have been several trials, and some of the trials actually made the infection worse, it increased the incidence of infection. In others, it didn't help one way or the other. So not all infections are vaccinatable, or at least vaccinatable by the common techniques that we use. And FIP is one of them. I published a paper quite a few years ago, which I predicted that FIP would be a difficult disease to vaccinate, as would HIV, just based on our knowledge of how these viruses cause disease or don't cause disease, and how they persist in the body in the face of immunity. You know, there is an old saying that vaccines aren't going to do much different than the natural infection does. So if the course of a natural infection is to have a primary disease stage and then be a carrier for the rest of your life, which is what HIV is like, you're not going to improve on that natural immunity by artificial injections of the virus or parts of the virus. So there is limitations to vaccines, and those limitations are apparent when you study what we call the pathogenesis of the way the disease exists in the body.
So with what you just said, I feel like I should ask you then about COVID-19 and how important you think a vaccine is compared to what might just be considered a natural or herd immunity.
Well, again, that's an interesting question based on the existence. There are four coronavirus virus species that exist in humans right now. They've entered humans from other animal species over the last half century or less, and they cause basically mild colds in the wintertime, and the mortality and morbidity is high, but the mortality is very low. And so they haven't been significant enough to warrant mass vaccination and that type of thing. So we've basically lived with them. And, of course, you know, colds are caused by many different viruses, and the syndrome is similar, but many different viruses. So basically we've just kind of said, you know, we're going to live with those diseases because it's just too complicated and probably not worth the money to vaccinate. And so that's, again, if you look at the history of these viruses in animal species, how they've entered and adapted themselves and become basic, just low-grade infections that flare up now and then. If you look at that history, one could predict the same thing might happen with the virus that causes COVID-19, that it will adapt with time and through mutation and become more easily transmissible but less virulent or less pathogenic. And that's been the history of these viruses. And so, and we already know that the SARS-2 coronavirus that causes COVID-19, we know already that it is mutating and that it is maybe gaining infectivity and maybe even losing virulence as it goes. And so we don't know what's going to happen over the next few years with this virus. I think we're looking forward with some degree of fear, but maybe that fear is not fully justified. We don't know. It could go many different directions, but if we look at history and we look at these other coronavirus infections that have come into animal species as well as into humans, we might make a prediction that the virus is going to come to live with us in a fairly easy manner. You know, there is a kind of saying among infectious disease people that these agents, these viruses and bacteria that cause disease, they don't want to kill their host. They want to live with their host because that's a perfect kind of relationship. So if they can establish a relationship where they exist in the body and they transmit to other hosts but do not cause disease or anything in the host, that's a kind of a perfect host-parasite relationship. And if we look at a lot of the virus infections of animals and humans, that's exactly how they behave.
Hmm. I'm talking with UC Davis Distinguished Professor Emeritus, Dr. Niels Petersen, and I want to get back to cats and the relationship and discovery with Gilead, based in Foster City, California. So you started thinking about antivirals, and this story is mapped out in a brand new story published by The Atlantic Monthly, written by Sarah Zhang. But you've published quite a bit. You knew the company's former chief scientific officer, and you had access to testing molecules. So of all that you chose, two proved to be promising. Will you tell me about that early discovery?
Yeah, I got to know Dr. Bishop, Norbert Bischofberger, who was one of the founding people in Gilead years ago in the 80s when I was working with HIV and AIDS and with the Primate Center working on simian immunodeficiency virus as a model of human AIDS. So we were able to test some of their early compounds when Gilead was just new. Well, to make a long story short, years later I read some of their work on trying to find antivirals for Ebola virus. And so I thought, well, you know, knowing that these companies usually make a whole battery of different compounds, different iterations of compounds, that they would have a library that they might want to share with us to see, you know, screen that library of drugs to see if there were any of those drugs that would cross-react or protect against the FIP coronavirus. So it took us about a year of a lot of wheeling and dealing trying to get material transfers agreements and that type of thing. And finally, we were able to, and we received a group of compounds, 20-some compounds, which we screened, and we found two of those that were highly effective and very safe, non-toxic against the FIP coronavirus. And we, when we reported on those two drugs, it turned out that the two compounds were closely related to each other. There was one compound called GS441524, which was a nucleoside analog that inhibited the production of RNA by the virus. And then there was another compound, which they had a number, which we didn't know at the time what that number stood for, but it was remdesivir. And remdesivir is basically a form of GS441524 that's been modified to increase its biological activity and maybe make it a little bit more absorbable by cells. So some simple chemical modifications are made in remdesivir. And so when remdesivir gets into the cell removes all of these extra components and yields basically GS441524, which then becomes the active ingredient, which is triphosphorylated by the cell and becomes the nucleotide which inhibits the RNA synthesis of the virus. So we basically, when we saw that, we reasoned that the GS being simpler in chemical structure would be easier to make and cheaper to make, and we knew that expense was going to be a problem in cats, not so much for humans, but a problem in cats. And so at first they were agreeable to, you know, basically using GS441524 for animals.
Meaning Gilead. Gilead was agreeable.
Yes, Gilead. And that they would then pursue their development of remdesivir for humans. But then what happened, and I think it may be reasonable on their part, they reasoned that maybe something that we would do with cats would have a negative, not a positive, would have a negative impact on their ability to eventually get approval and market remdesivir. So they basically said, well, we're not going to grant you animal rights because we're worried that it'll interfere with our human production. And so that happened, but in the meantime, we had completed a field trial where we actually used the GS441524 to treat 31 cats, and we were able to cure 25 of those cats of their FIP, which is a humongous, a huge accomplishment because this disease was 100% fatal up to that time, and so, and no treatment, we could prolong life, but we couldn't cure them. But it, so it was a kind of a great finding. And it's also so happened that FIP has been increasing in incidence all over the world as more and more people have been trying to save cats from the streets, and rescue foster organizations have come online, more and more of them. And kittens have been saved rather than put to sleep. And in the process of this whole movement of not putting, you know, putting feral cats or kittens that are born in the streets to sleep because we can't find homes for them, basically they created in an environment or a situation where the incidence of FIP became really quite huge. Also in Asia, cats, as dogs and some other pets, have become more and more popular as restrictions have been eased for owning pets. Cats became a very popular pet, and one of the major sources of those pets was the street cats, but also catteries, purebred catteries, became very in vogue in China. And catteries are another situation where FIP is a serious and important disease. And so worldwide, about 1.3% of all cats die of FIP. So it's not a small, insignificant disease.
Dr. Peterson, I just have a short amount of time left, and I just have one more question. So you're now 76 years old. You're semi-retired. All of these decades you were working on finding this cure for FIP, you found one. It can't be licensed. A similar compound might save the lives of humans now. So a black market has been created. And in a short amount of time, can you just tell me where you are on this issue of the black market for these medicines that are available to save cats in their FIP battle?
Okay, so there was a great need for a drug to cure cats of FIP. It was worldwide. It was particularly intense in Asia. So Asians, the Chinese are very good at marketing and making and synthesizing drugs. So they took the compound, they synthesized it, and they started making it and using it in their own to treat their own cats. And then this just kind of spread naturally to all over the world. And so this this unapproved market developed, and there was a huge demand for it. And so basically that's where we're at right now, that we do not have an approved drug where veterinarians can buy and prescribe it. We have this strange black market where people can get the drug, buy it, take it to their veterinarian, and have their veterinarian help them administer it.
And that's not the outcome you were hoping for, is it?
No, it wasn't. My hope was that we would have an approved drug and that it would be marketed in the usual manner.
Well, I'd like to continue this conversation in the future because there may be a cross of paths here. And of course, Gilead is the company in common. But I'm so glad to have reestablished the connection with you. I thank you for your time today. And let's go on with this conversation in the future because I know your work is going on too.
You're welcome. We're still trying to search for more drugs that we can make legal.
Okay, Dr. Peterson, thank you so much. Take care and be safe.
Yep, you too. Bye.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.